Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
This week we will be discussing the Grail, and with the Grail the first question is always, what will we be discussing? Because the first question, and perhaps even the final one, is always, what is the Grail? But in the hope that we are able to answer this question somewhat, we will also be taking a tour across Europe. It's after all summertime, and we will be meeting some of the places which has a or the Grail. Places such as Bruges, Mantua, and the Spanish countryside known as Aragon. So, Kathleen, what is the Grail?
Oh, yeah, thanks for starting off with an easy question. I love this question, and I think this is a question that so many of us have been exploring for a very long time. It is a question with no answer, which is, I think, what makes it so tantalizing and so extraordinary for all of us. I've been reading about the Grail since I was a very little girl, when I first fell in love with all the Arthurian legends, and first thought that it was the cup of Christ, which maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. And I think that, there is no easy answer, there's no short answer. I think it is a lot of things, and I think that the answer, what is the Grail, is kind of like asking, what is God? I think everyone is going to have a different perspective, a different idea, a different relationship with it, depending on how involved they are with these mysteries. I think if you ask the average person on the street who has seen Indiana Jones movies and read Arthurian books or not, I think the average person identifies it with the cup. And we're certainly going to talk about some of those places where we have seen cups or things that claim to be that. Certainly in more recent years, we see different perspectives of the blood being the Grail, the holy blood. In some cases, as we will also see, as we're going to discuss today, you and I have both traveled around Europe looking for holy blood, where it exists, and there are vials of it, and there are fantastic legends about how it all comes to be. Certainly, since the Da Vinci Code, people talk about the Grail as being the vessel, the female vessel, the womb that carried the bloodline. But I think it is all of those things, and I think it is more. I had a little fun with Facebook last week where I posted that question, what is the Grail? What does the Grail mean to you? And we got a lot of responses, but most of them were similar. I think a lot of my Facebook friends are readers and people who are extremely interested in this subject matter. And I think there were some really enlightened, lovely responses, and most of them were about the Grail being the quest itself. That the Grail is the quest for something divine that exists within all of us, some kind of mystery that we're all trying to touch. And I think that for me, the Grail is the journey as opposed to the destination.
Yes, and I think that's kind of where I come from as well. Definitely this idea that if you want to take the Grail down to a very materialistic manner, and I quite often think that people do need this materialistic idea that the Grail is something material to actually go on the Grail quest, and then they probably find that the Grail actually isn't about retaining this cup or whatever it is, but that it is something about something far bigger. And that is something which I kind of like felt as well in my quest. I have written a book, Servants of the Grail, which some people say can be interlaced with yours, The Book of Love, and it definitely touches upon the same subjects. Now, when I started doing research for Servants of the Grail, one of the things I definitely came up with was that I started to look in Chrétien de Troyes. Chrétien de Troyes is the first person who starts to talk about the Grail within the concept of using that word Grail. And he actually leaves what the Grail specifically is empty. He doesn't name it. He just refers to this Gradalia and leaves everybody guessing as to what it actually is. And what I found interesting is that in subsequent years, they find, and it's very much like the Da Vinci Code or other books in more recent years, the Grail story as told by Chrétien de Troyes became extremely popular, and there were spin-offs, and there were people who began to speculate as to what it was. And it created a reaction from the church, and the church began to identify this very specifically as saying, oh, well, it's got to do with Jesus Christ, of course, what else would it be? And it had to do, and that it had to do with the passion, that it just was an object which was able to capture the blood of Christ, because what else would there be more important than this blood of Christ? And you can see this quite clearly in how Cistercian monks specifically are almost asked to write about this concept, are basically trying to take away the mystery of the Grail and this undefined nature of the Grail and make it very specific. Now, when you start looking into what Chrétien is saying, and people like two brothers Kahane, who are actually, I think they're connected with Princeton, but they're connected to a big American university, when they started to analyze aspects of Chrétien's story, the most interesting aspect I always felt is that they analyzed the Grail procession and how it is made up. And they have straightforwardly identified that Chrétien's very detailed description of this Grail procession is a perfect copy of a procession involving Isis, the way it was written down in the Golden Ass legend of Lucius and told. And this is like, you know, a Roman story. And then the next thing which I felt was something kind of, you know, the fact that I became obsessed with Wolfram. Wolfram to me was a guy who said, everybody before me has got it so wrong, and I'm going to tell you the truth. And the truth is that this is a family history, and that this involves a very important event. And by the way, everything I'm going to tell you is fact. It's not fiction. And what I hated was when I started reading certain books of certain people who will remain anonymous, that they immediately start to say, well, we all know Wolfram's story is completely fictitious. Now, Wolfram is a person who in his entire life never wrote a single piece of fiction. He was a non-fiction writer, specifically writing family histories. It's what he did time and time and time and time and time again. Yet some people, like the person who will remain anonymous, even though he's on the tip of my tongue, he just kind of like pushes all of this tremendous evidence aside just to make this ridiculous claim that Wolfram's story is fictitious. Because if it is fictitious, people can just brush it away as if it doesn't exist and if it's not important. And that to some extent is where a lot of this Grail information has gone, in my opinion, wrong, in the sense that we have pushed it into mythology and have just seen it as some kind of literary device or a literary fiction or a kind of trend of books which appeared in medieval times. That's definitely not the case. It's both a story of families who are involved in certain endeavors, and at the same time it's directing these families not towards the search for a cup allegedly to do with Christ, but it's the story of families like the Aragons and various other people who were heretics, who had certain knowledge, some of it to do with Christianity and the real origins of Christianity, and some of it even predating that. Some of them, you know, like going beyond the origins of Christianity. You might say where Christianity comes from itself. And my initial focus was on Aragon, as I said, but you were involved at the same time as I was doing the Aragon research in some other families in Europe, and that kind of became the story of the Book of Love.
It did, and before we get to that, I want to back up to something you said, because I think it's incredibly interesting. It was the first time, certainly, I had ever heard it was from you, and I think that you said it very quickly in this last passage where you had a lot of information and a lot of it was really important. So I just want to stop for a second because I think some of our listeners may be hearing for the first time, as I had, what you said, which is that the analysis of Chrétien's Grail procession matched a procession to Isis. And I would love for you to talk about that for a minute. What do you think that means? Where does that take us? And is that what you mean when you're talking about the origins that predate Christianity?
There's very specific. Chrétien is the first person to write about the Grail, so he comes up with all of this information. Now, at a very first layer approach, what is clear is that he has information at his hands which is unchristian in origin, and which dates back to, you know, about 1,000 years before him. Now, the question then is, why is he so interested in doing this? Is he merely doing this because he likes to write about it, or is there something more to it? And this is where I kind of like tag into what most researchers do about Chrétien's origin, which is to do with the fact that he's asked to write about it. His master, Philip of Flanders, and specifically his wife, asks Chrétien to write a story. And it's known that Chrétien was given a certain number of books. Now, we do not know precisely which these books are, where they come from, but definitely part of these books involves a procession. And it's a procession to Isis, and we all know how important Isis was in Roman times. So what Chrétien is doing is not so much revealing a big secret. It's not something which nobody before him had never known before. What Chrétien is doing is pushing into the public consciousness something which was either forgotten or wasn't of paramount importance to them in roughly 1100. So he is going back to a time of about 1,000 years before, when worship of Isis was far more important, and he makes that the centerpiece of his book. So that is something I think which is definitely a conclusion which we can sketch and write on everything, which is that this is definitely what was happening there. Now, the reason why he was doing this, the reason why his superiors, his hosts were doing this, whether this was just part of something which was a one-off or a far bigger campaign, are things which really nobody has really looked into, because everybody who looks into Chrétien de Troyes, and specifically the Grail tradition, is still way too focused on this Cup of Christ mythology.
So do you think that this concept of the procession to Isis is Isis specifically? Do you think it is allegorical for a larger divine feminine element that they're writing about? Is Chrétien writing a great piece of fiction, or is he commissioned to write some kind of encoded teaching tool by the nobility in Flanders?
It's definitely the last bit. Now the question is, how far would he have taken this? And it's almost very much like try to imagine that Dan Brown just writes the Da Vinci Code and he never writes anything else. And you then would kind of like pose an awful lot of questions about who this Dan Brown character is. Why did he do it? Now, we know, you know, that Dan Brown is a novelist, and that he's written three other books, which are basically search and replace copies of the Da Vinci Code. So we know about Dan Brown. We know far less about Chrétien de Troyes. Chrétien de Troyes really, in retrospect, just pissed something out there. And whether he did this as part of a series, or whether it was just a one-off, whether his superiors just tried to see what was going to happen if something like this were to be done, that is really something which, at this moment in time, is in the realm of speculation still.
And so then we come back to, you know, something that has happened so often in the history of these mysteries, which is, there is an element where the church steps in, the story is changed, and that is the story that is propagated and becomes a popular story. So the deeper meaning of what Chrétien may have been writing is lost, or certainly in the shadow of this new legend about the cup. And where the legend of the cup becomes interesting is that even that is not something that anyone agrees upon. What is the cup? What does it look like? What was it used for? Is it the cup that was used to catch the blood of Christ, or is it the cup that was used at the Last Supper, or is it both? You know, again, my favorite word when talking about all of these mysteries is the word conflation, because conflation is our biggest enemy in trying to understand everything. Because this is what happens. All of these stories get mixed together. All these stories exist in one way or another, and then they're all conflated. They're all sort of layered on top of each other over hundreds and hundreds of years of retelling. And at the end of it, what we have is this sort of amalgamation of all of these stories. So none of it's true. All of it's true. It's really like throwing history into a blender, and it all ends up, you know, sort of coming together in a strange way. So I think our challenge as historians and as people who care about these mysteries is to try to separate all the ingredients and backtrack and look at where they all came from, because they all matter. But they all come from a different place, from a different perspective.
Yes, and I think, you know, the way or the situation in which we find ourselves to do with the Holy Grail is precisely what the church wants it to be. They knew that when they made this into the cup of Christ, that there would be endless speculation about which cup and how it ended up and where it was. And this is precisely the nitty-gritty detail which the church wants people to get bogged down in. Because that way, you know, it becomes a far less important. It's also absolutely no longer the heretical message which is in there and which we'll come back to, and it is something which they can control. It's from something which was about to become a wave across Europe, which could potentially drive away from the emphasis of the church, and it's the traditional, it's always the traditional aspect, which is the church wants you to go to a priest, confess all your sins so they can use it against you in a social setting without you actually ever figuring out that this is what is happening, and you relying on the church hierarchy to say your thanks to God and just sit in a church and do nothing conscious. All of these traditions, whether it's the Renaissance movement with the emphasis on the Corpus Hermeticum and various other wisdom traditions, or what I believe was also the same knowledge which was seeping into Europe from Moorish countries, specifically Spain, 300 years before, that knowledge has to do with self-realization, self-actualization, and realizing that what you're doing is important and doesn't need the negotiation of this priest. And I also think that, and I'm slightly jumping ahead here, but when you trace down, as I did, where Wolfram's story comes from, you end up in Aragon, which is basically a country on the Spanish-French border around the Pyrenees. And it is not only there that you will find Catharism, but it's also the Aragon kings who have always been the protectors of anything to do with Catharism. And then obviously we identify Catharism as once again this drive of self-realization. So you keep coming back to the same kind of themes time and time again. And the church would so much love for you to not focus on this and just focus on a rather silly quest as to where potentially, you know, the cup of Christ might be. And it really is almost like going into a shopping window, as in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and identifying which one it is. And that is, even for the church today, what the entire Grail quest has come to be.
In this addition to this idea of look over here, you know, look over here, this is a cup, go look for this cup, because if you're looking for this cup, this really important cup, and finding this cup is the most important thing that you can do for your church, then you really aren't paying attention to the real message. As you say, the real message, which is the personal relationship to God, which is gnosis, which is having a personal, spiritual, deep connection to the divine, and digging deeper into these mysteries and how we are all connected to them. And then from my point of view, and based on what I write, there's the whole element of the importance of the women in these stories. If you are looking for a cup, you are no longer looking for these Grail maidens. You are no longer paying attention to the fact that all of these legends of the Grail, the earliest legends, are all about the women, how the women are the protectors of the knowledge, how the women are the keepers of the women are the keepers of the Grail. This is what starts to get lost as we become obsessed with the quest for the cup. And this is why I wanted to go back to that whole idea of what happens with Chrétien possibly depicting a procession of Isis. One of the things that I write about, and I'm continuing to write about more now, is this idea of how powerful women have been through history in protecting the spiritual traditions, and specifically protecting these heretical spiritual traditions. Recently, you and I have been doing a lot of work on the Shroud and have been to Turin to look at the Shroud, but unlike most Shroud researchers, we're looking at it from a very different point of view. We are looking at the women who protected it, who were the caretakers of it, who ensured that it was used in very spiritual ways and presented and allowed for the people to see it. I think it's very interesting that when the Shroud was in the hands of women, it was available for public viewing almost all the time. And then as soon as it gets into the hands of the church, it's locked up and no one's allowed to see it. So, you know, we see this pattern over and over again. And I think that a lot of this has to do with the loss of the important female traditions in Christianity, which become the secret, heretical, hidden traditions in Christianity. And I truly believe that that's what a lot of the Grail legends are about. And the segue there is that it takes me to Matilda and to the reasons I wrote The Book of Love, my second novel in the Magdalene Line series. Those who have read The Book of Love are familiar with the story of Matilda, the Countess of Canossa, extraordinary woman from the Middle Ages who changed the world, and yet so few people in the English-speaking world certainly know who she is. And so I went on my own Grail quest to find Matilda and to tell her story. That quest for Matilda took me to Mantova, which is a city that was very much part of her domain in northern Italy, north of Tuscany. Matilda, there's a very, very interesting story about Matilda and about her mother. Now, there is, in the Basilica of Sant'Andrea, the Basilica of St. Andrew, in the middle of Mantova, there is a very important relic there called the Relic of the Holy Blood. So here is where we come to a place where the Grail is once again an item. Okay, the Grail in this case, Sangreal, sacred blood, is the blood of Christ. Now, the legend here is very interesting, and certainly for those of you who have read my books, you will recognize a very important character in this legend, and that character is Longinus the Centurion. And Longinus the Centurion, it is believed, came to this part of Italy following the crucifixion, and he carried with him, amongst other things, including the Spear of Destiny and his own story, this vial of blood, which was believed to have come from Jesus. And the vial itself was said to be magical, and the blood would liquefy and dry up, and extraordinary miracles happened around this blood. Now, this blood was held in Mantova for hundreds of years until about the end of the 9th century, I believe. And what happened was, at this time, Italy was being invaded by the Hungarian hordes, who were massacring Italians and robbing the monasteries. It was all about knowing that there was extraordinary wealth in the monasteries, and so the Hungarians were coming in, sacking the monasteries and killing everybody. So as the Mantovans, or Mantovanis, discovered that the Hungarians were coming, the monks decided that they would hide their most sacred relic, which was the Relic of the Holy Blood, and they buried it in the monastery grounds. The Hungarians came in, massacred the people of Mantova, massacred the monks, and no one was left alive in the monastery. But they did not get the Holy Blood. However, it was lost to posterity because nobody knew where it was, because everyone who had been involved with protecting it was now dead. Now, we cut to Matilda is born in 1046, and I think she's about 2 years old when... Now, here is the original version of the story, and this is important. The original version of the story, which is no longer the story that is told, is Matilda's mother, Beatrice of Lorraine, a Grail princess, if ever there was one, has a vision. In her vision, she sees where the Holy Blood is buried. She then takes a retinue of people out to this place that she has dreamt about. They dig and they find the Relic of the Holy Blood. Now, the story has been retold many, many times in the last 1,000 years, and it has been altered. And it has been altered so that it is no longer Beatrice of Lorraine who has the vision. There are various versions that there is an old monk, there is a blind monk, but there is always someone who is related to the church who actually has the vision now of where the blood is buried. Beatrice becomes this monk's patroness and pays for the excavation, and the blood is found, and there is great celebration. Even to this day, when you go into the Basilica in Mantova of the Holy Blood, the Basilica of Sant'Andrea, which was built during the early Renaissance by the Gonzaga family, paid for it, very important family, built, designed by Alberti, in very, very beautiful, extraordinary basilica. In it, there is a mural, a huge painting of the blood being found. And the mural of the blood depicts Beatrice of Lorraine holding... a nurse holding the infant Matilda standing next to Beatrice of Lorraine and the monk showing them where the blood is. So what happens in this extraordinary story is the woman with the vision is removed And this is what we see over and over again. The stories of the Grail, whether they're literal Grail elements, like in this case, a vial of blood, exist and endure. But where women have been important in the preservation of the mysteries, they are extracted or diminished. So in this case, Beatrice ceases to be the visionary or the prophetess and just becomes the person who pays for the excavations to happen because the church has had the vision and the church sees it.
And so we've got so far two layers. One of them is that the object has been Christianized, women have been removed from the story, and then the third one is that the men have become fictionalized, because what I found was such an important and such a central aspect of the Grail is this, that we know who the people in the Grail story are. And it's a very simple story, which I have told a number of times, so I'll just repeat it here because it's so interesting. André de Mandac is a German student who a few years ago did a PhD thesis, which unfortunately is only available in French and German. André de Mandac looked into Wolfram von Eschenbach and accepted that Wolfram was factional rather than fictional. And he says the following. He says, Wolfram gives hundreds of names. For a fiction writer, this is something of a silly argument because he doesn't really use that many characters in his book. So it's like a genealogy. It reads like a genealogy, and it is because it is a genealogy. And he identifies various people as being real people who have lived. But the most important people are obviously the Fisher King and Percival. What we know about Percival is that he is a young boy who goes on a trek after his father is dead, and he finds his uncle living in the Grail Castle. Now, to cut a very long story short, Percival, as a name, is made up of two parts, Perce and Val. When you turn them around, you have got Val and Perce. And it just so happens that the Valley of the Perce has got a family who lived there in medieval times, and they are called the Perce family. And their chief prodigy is a person called Rotrud II, the Perce. And he's a very famous person. If you Google him, if you go on Wikipedia, or if you read Servants of the Grail, you will find lots of references to Rotrud II. If you are in Chartres, going to Chartres Cathedral, where the Book of Love is set amongst other places, you will find signposts to Nogent le Rotrud. And Rotrud is actually named after Rotrud II, the Perce. So they are a family who are from that area, and actually a number of people of their family became bishops of Chartres and were actually very influential in the construction of the Cathedral of Chartres when it was constructed. Now, it just so happens that this dynasty, which has long since gone, was indeed connected to the Aragon kings, specifically one character, Alfonso II of Aragon. Alfonso II of Aragon is the Fisher King. Now, what do we know about the Fisher King? The Fisher King lives, obviously, in the Grail Castle and is unable to reproduce. These are the principal aspects, as well as being the uncle to to Percival. As it just so happens to be, Alfonso II of Aragon is the uncle to Rotrud II. He lives in a veritable Grail Castle called San Juan de la Peña, which his grandfather has constructed, just like the grandfather of the Fisher King has constructed the Grail Castle, as Wolfram von Eschenbach relates it. And oh, miracle of miracles, it just so happens that Alfonso II of Aragon was unable to create offspring. And this is actually a very interesting saga, because Alfonso II's brother is a bishop. Just like in the Grail story, the Fisher King's brother is called the Hermit, the person who tells Percival the story of the Grail and how he should live in a certain manner, which is deemed to be appropriate to attain salvation or enlightenment or whatever you want to call it, as Kathleen was referring to it earlier, Gnosis. Now, the interesting aspect is that Alfonso II of Aragon was going to leave his country to the three monastic orders, the Knights Templars being the most famous one of them. As it just so happens, Wolfram von Eschenbach identifies the Templars as protectors of the Grail. And European history would have been far different if something hadn't happened at the very most last moment in time, because upon Alfonso II's death, when everything is supposed to be happening, that his kingdom is divided into three and distributed amongst the monastic orders, what happens is that the people say, we cannot allow this to happen, and they go to his brother, who's a bishop, and they get special papal dispensation to say, you should have sexual intercourse with a woman, and by the way, in the eyes of God, this will never happen. And as soon as you have created offspring, you're allowed to go back into your monastic calling, and we never need you ever again, because you have created an offspring for the Aragon kings. And that is what happens. And hence, what was going to happen doesn't happen. And that is part of the reason why Wolfram actually tells this story, because Wolfram is writing approximately 100 years after all of these events have transpired, and he wants to educate people as to how on the borders of France and Spain, a vastly different scenario was transforming, and a group of people lived there who were trying to get a very important and serious message out about how all of these things came about. And Wolfram is writing about this at a moment in time when the Cathars, who live in that region, are being persecuted by the church. And so we find various layers whereby, the men, or the official history of what happened to do with the Grail, is once again completely bypassed, and the elements of spirituality, which are so important to the Grail characters, and the manner in which a Grail court existed, and the principles which these people adhere to in roughly 1100, and which then were completely demoted because the Grail was made into this object, which was just the cup of Christ, is also written out of history.
Okay, so one of the things that I found really revolutionary about what you had written in Servants of the Grail, and I had never really seen it laid out like this in any way, is that basically you're saying that Wolfram is telling the story of this line of Aragon nobility, and that these are real people, and that this is a real story, and that the Fisher King is more than allegory. There was really a person who fits this role, and that you find this over and over again, that Percival is really a person. I had never really encountered it in that way, certainly not the way that you have laid it out, which is brilliant, and really exciting, and really, really cool. What I want to go back to for a minute is, where does this take us spiritually? When we say, okay, this Aragonese family are the models, they are the characters that Wolfram is writing about in Parsifal. Okay, I completely get that, but where does that take us now in terms of the spirituality? What are the Aragon nobility protecting? Certainly what was beautiful for me when I read Servants of the Grail, having just published the Book of Love, and our books came out at the same time, and that was all very magical, and we'll talk about how that kind of brought us together, which was our own manifestation of the Grail, was this, this idea that we were really writing about the same thing at the same time, just sort of from a different point of view. So what I want to ask you to elaborate on a little bit is this whole concept of, okay, so we have the Aragonese kings and nobility who are doing incredible things and having this influence on things like Chartres, which was another revelation for me. But where are we spiritually with this? What are they protecting? What do they have? What do they care about? And where does this all take us on the spiritual quest for the Grail?
Well, I think what they had, there are several ways of answering this question, yet it's only using different terminology. So, as I point out in Servants of the Grail, when you look at the way Wolfram writes his Grail story, there are two major components. One of them is a basic genealogy of this family and how they have this object in their possession, and that is it. But at the same time, there's an enormous amount of spiritual material in there on how people should live. the most telling example, even though it's not the most spiritually rich one, is obviously when Percival arrives at the Grail Castle and sees this thing, and then kind of doesn't really know what's going on because he is far too Christian in his demeanor to understand the richness and the wealth of how these people live in this Grail Court. And he kind of like wakes up and kind of like doesn't really understand, and then a number of years later comes back, is more mature and realizes what is going on. Now, when you start to look at where Wolfram gets this other material from, you'll find that there's lots of astrological information in there. He's, for example, quite a bit of the Fish King's father is based on Saturn and everything to do with that star. There's the various references of how Wolfram says that the Grail is an object in the sky, which you could identify with a constellation. Now, all the more interesting material is in the form of a dialogue, which the Fisher King's brother has with Percival. And it would be an extremely long story to go into. But basically, that is identified as a Greek tradition, a Greek metaphor of how to impart knowledge. The Greeks love this question and answering session. And so when you take out those elements, as the Mandak and other people have done, from that material, and the Kahane brothers have done this as well, you can identify, sometimes word for word, sometimes slightly changed, aspects from what is now known as the Corpus Hermeticum, the Hermetic tradition, which officially only entered Europe in the 15th century because it was the likes of Ficino, which we love so much, and who is a prominent member of the Poet Prince book, which you released a few months ago. Officially, the Corpus Hermeticum only enters Europe in the 15th century through the Florentine court. Now, unofficially, or leading lights of medieval scholarship are actually saying that is not really sustainable, specifically when the Spanish people did the Reconquista, which was the fact that Spain was lost to the Moors from, I think, roughly the 9th century onwards. In the 11th century, Spanish kings decided to reconquer large parts of Spain, and the Aragons were the principal kings in this. When that happened, they not only conquered territory, they not only reclaimed Spain for Christianity, but they also came in contact with material which wasn't available in Christian Europe. And it is 99% sure that amongst this material was material along the lines of the Corpus Hermeticum. And they are quite adamant that for a very brief period of time, roughly around 1100, this created a new wave of a Renaissance, and they actually call it the pre-Renaissance or the proto-Renaissance, which entered Europe. And quite a few of them actually make links to Chartres Cathedral. They actually say that this knowledge, both in architecture and spirituality and on so many levels, contributed to Chartres before, and then it kind of like disappeared or went underground. Now, so that is one answer. When you then delve into what is the Corpus Hermeticum all about, and you go to the place where the Corpus Hermeticum comes from, which is Egypt, you find that the Corpus Hermeticum is identified as a accessible to the Greeks rendering of the Egyptian text known as the Book of Thoth, which is a wisdom tradition. And the Book of Thoth is, of course, a book. It's a book which is basically telling everybody this is what you need to know to live consciously, to live properly, and on top of that, there are several more volumes to do with architecture, which is why the Egyptians had such beautiful temples. There are things to do with alchemy. There are things to do with medicine, all the various science which the ancient Egyptians were working on. But at the very core, at the very basic essence of the Book of Thoth is a wisdom tradition on how to live properly. And that is the most important aspect of the Grail, and it's also the most important aspect of what Wolfram is trying to impart to Percival. Percival You know, when you look at the average Grail tradition, you have this knight who seems to jump on a horse and travels across Europe in search of whatever it is, but it's supposed to be the cup of Christ. And that is what all the fictional stories and the movies are about. At the very fundamental core of Wolfram's tradition is the story of a knight who's quite good with a sword, comes to this Grail castle and says, like, hey, can I join this Grail Brotherhood? Because I'm a really good swordsman, you know. And everybody kind of, like, looks at him and says, like, great. Wonderful. That, however, is not what it's about here. Yes, we are kings. Yes, we can do these dashing things with our swords and all of these other bravura things. But you don't get it. You do not live properly. So you go out into the world, and if ever you attain that knowledge, you can come back and you can live amongst us, and you will become part of the Grail Brotherhood. And then, of course, the other aspect which ties in very much with your research is the fact that Wolfram also writes about the Grail Dynasty, which are families who are linked to this tradition and who have infiltrated European nobility and who are hoping to bring about a revolution across the European continent, whereby Europe will eventually become ruled by noble families who are completely adhering to this spiritual message, which is, you know, what you have written about in your books, and which is always coming back to a very basic thing, which is you can get to God yourself through a Gnostic wisdom tradition. You should not rely on the hierarchy of the church to attain that.
And now we're back to Egypt again, because we're back to all of these original Hermetic traditions. So I want to segue there to this concept of the Book of Thoth, and then another fantastic subject, which we will do a whole show on later, because it's far too big to do today, but we will definitely do a show on the Emerald Tablet, or the Emerald Tablets, plural, as I believe that there are multiple, and a lot of people do believe, the source of alchemy. And I want to talk about that because, from the point of view of the Grail, one thing that we have not discussed yet is the concept of the Grail as a stone. And we see this over and over again in a number of the interpretations, some of the actual translations. I came across the concept of Grail as stone when I was studying Chart back in the 90s, in 1995, when I first was given Louis Charpentier's book, The Mystery of Chartres Cathedral. And he is the one who turned me on to this idea of the Grail as a stone, because he interprets the word Grail as Grael from an old French tradition, which means the stone of God. So what that means becomes, you know, another piece of the story. What is the stone of God? Is this the philosopher's stone of alchemy? Is it a reference to these extraordinary wisdom teachings that were said to be on stone, the Emerald Tablets? I definitely have a perspective on that. I think that there is definitely an Emerald Tablet connection to the Grail story, and I think it's an important one. You talk about a Grail stone in your own work, so will you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. Another thing which Wolfram gets extremely upset about is the following. So Chrétien leaves it unidentified as to what the Grail is. Afterwards, it's identified as a cup of Christ, and Wolfram kind of goes, no, everybody has got it wrong. And he says, the Grail is a stone. Now, he identifies the stone as having certain characteristics, which are definitely otherworldly. And what I find of interest is that he identifies the stone in such a way that it is very similar to other sacred stones of other sacred traditions, whether they are in Mexico or whether you listen to stories of ancient Egypt to do with the Benben stone, or whether you, as you were talking, the emerald tablet stones. There is a tradition across the world of magical stones which brings people into contact with God, through whatever means that is possible, and we'll probably do that in a follow-up show. These stones have certain qualities. And the only thing, because it's big enough, what Wolfram is saying, that one such sacred stone was in the possession of the Aragon kings. And again, it's a pars pro toto. By that I mean, you know, yes, they possess this stone, but it's the importance of the Grail Dynasty or the Aragon Kings should not be reduced to them simply having this stone. And this becomes apparent as well to the Aragon Kings as well, because they realize that the reason why they have this stone and why the Grail Maidens are running around the palace with this stone at certain moments of time in the year is just a part of it. In each tradition, you have the body of knowledge and then the tools through which you can celebrate this body of knowledge, which underlines the importance and through which various other things can be accomplished on top of that. And the stone is one of these objects. So as much as Wolfram kind of, you know, is underlining the spirituality, yes, there is also a physical grail. And Wolfram obviously is unable to go too much into an Egyptian connection, and even if he were, a medieval person in Europe would not understand what it is about. So Wolfram did something very interesting. And what he did was he linked it to an angelic tradition. And how he does it is as follows. We all know about the fall of mankind, whereby allegedly Lucifer had a row with God, and then the fall of angels happens, and then Saint Michael kind of like steps into Lucifer's place, and ever since we are looking for rectifying this situation. This is a basic standard view of Christianity and accessible to every medieval Christian. Wolfram does a spin-off of this, and he says, but what you did not know is that there were neutral angels, that there were some creatures in heaven who kind of like said, well, we don't really get what this wager is between God and Lucifer, and we don't really like what Lucifer is doing, and we don't really get why God kind of like gave this to Lucifer, and they're basically sitting around. And they become, in Wolfram's rendition, more important afterwards, because once Lucifer and God has done their stuff, they kind of go, okay, so you've got a situation, let us help you with this one. And Wolfram writes about how it are these neutral agents who place upon earth a stone where angels can ascend back and forth and through which mankind can once again get in contact with God and once again can have this ascension process. And that is a very Christian rendition of, you know, the wisdom tradition, whereby you learn certain aspects of how to make direct contact with God and also to paint the larger framework. So what Wolfram did with making the neutral angels come up in this story is basically give certain pagan information, certain heretical information, Christianize it somewhat, but specifically make it understandable as to what was really happening at the Aragon court. Before kind of like moving on to some other things, one thing I think which I always found interesting and kind of like what happened as well last year when we started to compare Servants of the Grail and the Book of Love was that, of course, in the appendix to the Book of Love, a copy, or the original rather, of the Liber Rosso somehow is in Aragon country, specifically at the moment in time when all of these things at the Grail Castle happen as well. And I think it's another level that, you know, you have magical stones, you have Grail traditions, but also the Liber Rosso is part of this, because the Liber Rosso, the Emerald Tablets, the Book of Thoth, they are all wisdom traditions and all bodies of knowledge which indicates to people how they should live and what is truly important.
Well, the Book of Love, certainly the original copy of the Book of Love following the fall of Montsegur, ends up in Aragon territory, in Montserrat. And I, you know, of course, when we start putting all this together, it all matters. In the same way that the fact that in the Aragon stories, the Grail Maidens are carrying the stone. They're the keepers of the stones, and they're the ones who are doing these things with the stone. So once again, we have a metaphor for the women holding the truth. The women are carrying the instrument of Gnosis with them. So whether or not that is a physical instrument or it is an allegorical instrument, once again, you have to dig, but you see that it is the women who are at the heart of protecting all of the mysteries, and it is ultimately the women who hold the key. And this is certainly the Catholic tradition. The Catholic treasure is their daughters, who are the keepers of all of this information. We see over and over again in the southwest of France specifically, all of these statues of Saint Anne and the Virgin, and it's always a statue of Saint Anne in her very powerful prophetess teacher role. She's always veiled like a prophetess, and she's holding a book where she is showing Mary something in her reading. And certainly, the more we look at these photographs of Anne, and I have a lot of them on my Facebook, and we'll post some of them online as well, because they're extremely beautiful. It's mostly statuary, but sometimes it's also paintings. And what we see is that they cease to be depictions of Anne and Mary, and what they really are depictions of how the wisdom was passed in these Grail families. In the Grail families, you have this extraordinary tradition of the older women, the grandmothers essentially, passing on the mysteries to the younger women. And this was how it went. Because, by the way, the mothers were really busy. The mothers in these families were busy, not just having children, but, you know, essentially a lot of these families, you know, were sort of subtle matriarchies. So the women were extremely important and very active in the running of the day-to-day life of the families, of the nobility, of even in many cases the kingdoms. So what's happening is you have the girls are being taught the mystery traditions by their grandmothers. And this is what you see over and over again in this statuary that appears on the surface to be Anne teaching Mary, because, again, this is an acceptable way to couch this in Christian tradition. This is something that's understood and is acceptable. I mean, what we see through all of this, whether it's Wolfram or the art and the sculpture of the time, is we see, again, encoding for those with eyes to see. But no, it's not a coincidence by any stretch that the real Book of Love, the authentic one, the gospel that is written in Jesus' own hand, ends up in Aragon territory. I love Montserrat. It's an incredibly special place. It's protected by St. Michael, in addition to being, you know, sort of the Black Madonna site, as far as I'm concerned. And what I learned from you was the importance of San Juan de la Peña, also in Aragon territory. And what I truly believe, having now been to both of these places, is that Montserrat is very much the feminine site, and San Juan de la Peña has a lot more of this masculine energy. And of course, San Juan de la Peña means St. John of the Rock. So that's my question for you is, you know, where does the rock come in here?
Well, it's definitely a very important site. And the St. John is referenced to St. John the Baptist. The reason why it's a rock has to do with the fact that it really is a rock castle. It's, for people who haven't seen it, the closest parallel is probably to the dwellings which you find in Arizona, and which have to do with the ancestral Puebans or the Anasazi or the Hopi, whatever name you want to give, the people who lived there and still live there, and who built these tremendous houses in the gorges of Arizona. One such house is, you know, in San Juan de la Peña, and it's the Grail Castle. It's where the kings of Aragon were buried. It's where they wanted to have this water wash their bodies in death, and it is also where for them the Grail was kept. When you look at the Christianized rendering of this territory, of this monastery rather, you will find that what they have now known as the Valencia Cup, they have a replica there. And it's my contention that in 1400, 1399, when the Valencia Cup really comes about, this is once again another Christianized rendering of something far more heretical, which the church obviously had to Christianize because that's what they do. It's their job. But when you look at the place where they have posted or placed the Grail Cup right now, that is a place where before you would have sort of made the water magical, if you want, where you would have done something to the water while it is washing away the so-called sins of the people who are buried there. And as Christianized as that might be, that people are buried in water and then, you know, like the sins are washed away forever, it's actually once again a magical, folkloric, heretical practice, which the church just pretends is Christian because basically they're trying to get away with that. But again, Nothing about San Juan de la Peña is Christian, and even when it is Christian, and when you look at the two saints to which the lower chapels are dedicated to, you will find that those two saints somehow end up being the two saints which the Medicis in Florence hold so dear.
Cosmas and Damian. Yeah, the lower chapels are dedicated to Saints Cosmas and Damian, who were brothers and healers that the Medici revered. So, and that now brings us to a Medici connection, and that's the beauty of this, and we see it over and over again as we look at this, how all of these families are connected, and they are all Grail families. They are all keepers of the Grail in their own right. They are all servants of the Grail in their own right. And we, in the 21st century, are servants of the Grail ourselves, trying to find out what the real essence of the Grail is, which I believe is service to mankind and to the divine. So I think that we've pretty much covered the early stages of what the Grail means to us and what it can be. I think this is a subject that is so big. I want to have some guests on to talk about what the Grail is to them. So I think this is part one of something that's going to continue our discussion on the Grail. So for this week's version of the Spirit Revolution, we wish you very happy Grail hunting and tremendous magic on your own quest.
If you want to hear what we were just talking about again and again and maybe even again, we have a website which is called thespiritrevolution.com. You can also find all of our broadcasts so far on iTunes, and you can also log on to BBS Radio, which is bbsradio.com, where you will also find all of the archives listed. So until next time, from Kathleen and I,
the truth against the world. I need you to tell me the drive.